This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Do want to talk a little bit about Apple. We talked about it yesterday hitting or going beyond the $2.5 trillion market cap range. It rallied about 3% yesterday. It's down a little bit, just pulling back about 0.5%. And on the Bloomberg Terminal, you might have noticed a Bloomberg exclusive about Apple adding satellite features to iPhones for emergencies. We talked about that yesterday as well. Getting to that story, Bloomberg News technology reporter Mark Gurman covers Apple for us, with us now on the phone in L.A. So, Mark, what's up with this?
Thanks for having me. I mean, the end of August also means that we're getting pretty close to the launch of the next iPhones and the launch of the next Apple products. And what I was discussing yesterday is a slate of new features for emergencies and crisis and SOS calls that Apple is planning to add to the iPhone next year. These features would allow you, if you're in a plane crash, God forbid, or a boating accident, or a car crash, or a wildfire in areas without cellular connectivity, you'd be able to reach out to emergency services over satellite infrastructure. This would also allow you to text emergency contacts as well as emergency services over the satellite network through the Messages app. And this is a bit less involved. It's not as big of a deal, I would say, as some of the dreams people had about the iPhone turning into, you know, a sat phone, like you've seen in the classic Michael Douglas movie. But this is more about emergencies.
I was thinking about, and I have to say, in the newsroom, we were all like, wait a minute, are you talking about like those big phones used by the military that we always see up on the big screen, or the mobile phones we saw in the movie Wall Street, you know, going back to 1987? We're not talking about that.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about if you're in a plane crash or you fall off a mountain. Basically, there's this device called the Garmin InReach. And a lot of times people who do extreme sports or hikers and such, they buy this device because if something, God forbid, happens to them, this is how they save their lives. You can reach emergency services via text or call through this device that connects to Globalstar's satellite network. This is what Apple wants to integrate into the phone. Obviously, there's a lot at stake when you integrate this tech into a phone, meaning Apple can't really turn this into a sat phone. They can't afford to basically kill the carriers right now. The technology in order to make a true sat phone, like you said in the movie Wall Street in the military, there's a reason the phones are that big. They require special antennas and special infrastructure that is just not feasible to fit into an iPhone at this point with the battery life necessary. Something with that type of functionality is likely 5 to 10 years away. Mm-hmm. But at this point, we're talking about emergencies. And, of course, it's a very handy feature, and it will make the iPhone more useful to additional sets of people.
First of all, you said something. Apple can't afford to kill the carriers at this point. If they could, and if they could offer something that wasn't gigantic in your hand, it sounds like they would. And that's where eventually this is all going. Is that fair?
Eventually, right? But that's going to be well down the road, right? What Apple wants to do is they want to own the entire stack. They want to own the phone, they want to own the network, and they want to own as much as possible. But there's a lot at stake here. Apple can't just go around killing carriers that have helped them build the iPhone this long, right? Getting this infrastructure in place could take decades if you want to hit this globally, right? They can't just knock out one carrier in the U.S. and expect all the other carriers internationally to play ball with them, right? It's something that really would require threading the needle. It might never completely happen. It might be an option in some circumstances, but I think this emergency functionality is a very happy medium because you're doing something that the wireless carriers don't have coverage for.
Right.
This is basically mitigating the lost space on the planet without cellular connection.
Hey, Mark, so then I am curious for our audience, because I actually talked about this a little bit yesterday, because there were some satellite companies moving on this news, and there was there were analysts weighing in and saying, you know, Iridium might be the likely, you know, satellite company that partners up. Anything like this, as you said, 5 to 10 years approximately away. So if someone's trying to make an investment play on this in terms of the satellite play, it's probably too early?
I spoke to people who would know, and this report from an analyst at William Blair that said Apple is likely to work with Iridium is simply not true.
Okay.
My understanding is they're not talking to Iridium about this. they held brief discussions with them just to gauge, you know, knowledge about the satellite networks maybe a year or two or three ago. But since then, there hasn't been any talks with them. Globalstar put out an SEC filing in February 2020 that indicated that another company paid them, I believe, around $60 million to develop some infrastructure for some sort of product or service they can't talk about. To me, that screams Apple, but it's hard to know for sure. If anyone's network was able to do this, it would be Globalstar, but I will tell you that, from my understanding, Globalstar's network is not great. I have words to describe it that I can't say on the radio. It's not really suitable for anything other than emergency texts and such. And again, this is going to be in very limited areas.
Yeah.
If you need to call emergency services from the phone, you're going to get a prompt on the iPhone that tells you you need to walk around until you find a proper satellite. You're going to get error messages, right? This is no perfect technology. Globalstar has not nailed it. And that takes me to something I wrote about a couple of years ago, where Apple's ultimate goal is to deploy its own satellite infrastructure. That's going to be 5 to 10 years away, but it's certainly something we're working on.
Oh, I love talking with you. Globalstar was the one I was thinking about because it was up 64% yesterday, dropped back another 17% though today. But great to get the clarification. 30 seconds left. There's a story too. Apple's new watch likely to be delayed over production snags. What do we need to know just quickly?
Yeah, so we're hearing that Apple is facing some last-minute 11th-hour production issues on the Watch Series 7 because the new larger screen. It's unclear if this means a delayed release date or supply constraints. I still say that a new watch will be announced in the next 6 weeks.
All right. Good stuff, as always. Thank you so much. Covered it all. That is, of course, our Mark Gurman. He's a must-read here at Bloomberg. He's our Bloomberg News Technology Reporter, and he covers all things Apple. Check him out at Bloomberg.com, also on the Bloomberg Terminal, and always on his Twitter feed at Mark Gurman. Quick check on Apple shares. We know hitting $2.5 trillion in market cap just yesterday. Stock given back just about 0.5%, 152.35 the last trade. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week right here on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, a lot of headlines, of course, when it comes to COVID and the vaccine today. We had the European Union coming out, reaching a goal of fully vaccinating 70% of its adult population. Israel reported a record number of daily infections. And some news from Moderna about its vaccine being more effective in terms of immunity, potentially against Pfizer. So a lot to get through. And I believe that's pertaining to a booster shot specifically. Back with us is Dr. Mario Ramirez. He's managing director at the national nonprofit organization Opportunity Labs. They work with healthcare, education, housing. It's all about improving outcomes for low-income Americans. He also served as the acting director for the Office of Pandemic and Emergency Threats at HHS during the Obama administration. Great voice, for us. He joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Dr. Ramirez, good to have you back. There is a debate over booster shots, whether or not we should get it. Does it make sense? How do you see it and why?
So I am fully in favor of vaccine boosters for all Americans at this point, Carol. And I think this may stand in contrast a little bit to what the CDC's advisory committee issued yesterday. But the reason that I think it's a good idea for us to roll boosters out to everyone here in the United States is primarily based on what we're seeing in data coming out of Israel, where they had a significant surge related to Delta that coincided with a significant drop in the immunity provided by the Pfizer vaccine in that country between the 6 and 8 month mark. And the United States is at a position right now where we can sort of blunt the ongoing surge that we have here and prevent a worsening surge similar to what they experienced in Israel.
And there's enough evidence, there's enough medical evidence out there that the booster makes sense to have?
Well, that's an area of ongoing debate. And unfortunately, yeah, one of the things that we know during the pandemic, right, is that the speed of information that we can get from our gold standard, a randomized controlled trial, for instance, oftentimes takes too long relative to the speed of an outbreak. And in this instance, I think we need to depend on what we're seeing from other countries around the world that have served as good indicators for what we should expect here in the United States. We saw what happened in the UK. We've seen what happened in Israel over the last few weeks. And I think, unfortunately, we're unlikely to get that level of data here in the United States in time to blunt this worsening surge.
I've also never seen a situation like this. Of course, we haven't lived, for most of us, during a health pandemic, where it's kind of like what vaccine did you get? Oh, well, I got this one. And I say that because today we had news that Moderna's COVID vaccine generated more than double the antibodies of a similar shot made by Pfizer and BioNTech. And this is in those initial two doses, not a booster, which I think I said incorrectly before. So in that initial two doses, how are we as a general public supposed to kind of interpret that?
Yeah, you know, I think this is really interesting from the basic science perspective, Carol, right? I mean, I think what we saw from both Pfizer and Moderna at the 5 to 6 month mark was that these vaccines were, between the two of them, between 90 and 95% effective at preventing significant enough illness to put someone in the hospital, which is really ultimately what matters. In terms of the number of antibodies that are produced with either one of these vaccines, the more important determinant would be how long lasting that immunity is. And that might make or impart some ability to sort of make a relative quality judgment between those two. But at this point, we have seen evidence that shows that the efficacy for each of those vaccines is dropping off between the 6 and 8 month mark. And so that's really what's more important here, rather than the number of antibodies that get produced.
So it's a question I've often put to our medical community. What should I be marking on my calendar as a date to get my booster shot? Is it 6 months? Is it 8 months? I know we haven't gotten necessarily the final guidance on this, but what would you suggest?
So it's an area of ongoing guidance. I suspect that when all is said and done, we're going to land closer to the six-month mark. You know, the Biden administration put out the September 20th date as their original sort of line in the sand, and that was at the eight-month mark. And then we heard from the president that maybe they were thinking about moving that back to 5 months. And I think a lot of that is based on data that we're seeing from overseas, which is, you know, somewhat uncertain and not being conducted here in the United States, which makes interpretation more difficult. So it's a little bit of a moving target. But in my own opinion, based on what I've seen from overseas data, I think the 6 month mark for this sort of third shot or booster is probably where we're going to land.
All right. Going to leave it on that note. We really do always appreciate your time. Dr. Mario Ramirez, Managing Director of Opportunity Labs, as I mentioned, too, he was a former acting director at the Office of Pandemic and Emergency Threats. That was during the Obama administration.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, not sure if you've noticed with everything going on in our world, but jury selection underway in the trial of Elizabeth Holmes. Remember her? Founder of the blood testing startup Theranos. She is facing charges that she defrauded investors and patients by making false claims about her company's blood tests, as well as about the Theranos financial position. Tracking all of this for us here at Bloomberg, Bloomberg News legal analyst June Grasso. She's also host of Bloomberg Law weeknights at 10 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. She's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, Carol.
So tell us, what's the timeline? I mean, is this going to be a long trial?
It's going to be 3 to 4 months.
Okay.
So as they're sitting, these jurors, that's a consideration that they're telling them it's going to be 3 to 4 months. And also they ask them about COVID, by the way, one of the questions, whether they would sit in a courtroom for that long with COVID and whether they'd been vaccinated, among a questionnaire of about 28 questions that went into their hobbies, how much they knew about this case, which has been all over. You know, it's HBO documentaries. There are going to be movies made about it. So they asked them that, and they also there was a question about whether they were venture capitalists, what their experience with venture capitalists was. So it's going to be interesting.
Well, that's one of the things I want to get to. I mean, the trial's in Silicon Valley, right? I mean, so in terms of getting a jury that hasn't heard a lot of information about her and the company, is that going to be difficult? And is that something that maybe weighs in her favor, an argument that they can put out there?
Well, so far, there were about 200 in the potential pool that filled out that jury questionnaire. And according to the lawyers, about half of them knew about the case. But the judge has said that that is not going to stop a person from being on the jury. Because let's face it, in the George Floyd case, in the Marathon Bomber case, people know about this. It's something that you're not going to find someone. And you don't want someone who doesn't know anything about a case like this.
Right.
But what they have to do is make sure that despite what they know, that they can be fair, that they can judge it on what they see and hear in the courtroom and not what they know from, you know, from a movie that they saw or from an article that they read.
Well, and I do wonder if having some understanding of kind of the VC world and understanding how startups go, right? We cover it a lot here, and there are often a lot of claims made. There's a lot of money that gets involved, even in the early stages, that can go on for years, and then companies that just don't pan out here. How might that actually help her?
Well, I think that one of the things, and experts agree on this, that the defense would like to have, there are two kinds of jurors, I think. One is a juror that is – savvy about Silicon Valley startups, right, and sort of knows that a lot of this is puffery and what you have to do in order to get investors to come in. And against that is going to be the prosecution, which is going to say, we want a line between puffery and between actual fraud. We don't want this. This is the biggest fraud in Silicon Valley history. We don't want this to happen again. So here's the line. The other jury they're going to want is someone that's going to be sympathetic to her defense. She has, over the weekend, last Thursday, let's say, the judge released documents that had been under seal. So he unsealed them. And in that, it shows that the defense is going to try to show that she was physically, psychologically, and emotionally abused by Sonny Balwani, her former lover, and the president of the company.
Co-founder
for years.
Of the company, right?
Yes. That he controlled everything from what she ate to what she wore. And that she, so the process here, that alone is not a defense, but the defense would be duress, that she didn't know what she was doing. She had no choice in what she was doing because he was controlling her, sort of like the mastermind and the puppet, that he was controlling her, and that so she did what he said. It reminds me of the gun to the head defense. I had to do it because that person had a gun to my head, so she had no choice. And that would take away the intent element, which is the key element here. They have to show that she intended to deceive investors about this, investors and patients about this.
June, you've covered a lot of trials, a lot of legal situations, and I think about this one in particular. Almost everybody in the media, I know we at Bloomberg have done stories on her. I mean, for such a long time, she was a get. Everybody wanted to have a conversation with her because she was really kind of upending a big part of the testing world in terms of how things are. How will that, I don't know. I mean, this goes back to how do people kind of get their head around that?
It's such a tough sell to me because you have this image of her as being confident and self-assured.
A female Steve Jobs she was kind of put
exactly
out there.
Exactly. And also she cultivated that. She wore the turtlenecks. Right. She had the deep voice that some people say was a little bit put on. And so, and also the way she handled interviews and the way she answered questions. It's very hard to reconcile that with a woman who's being, you know, a puppet for someone else. The other thing, though, that she has on her side, though, is that Balwani is not in the courtroom because he's going to be tried separately. Because of this defense. He's going to be tried separately next year, and they can't call him as a witness because that would be against his Fifth Amendment rights. So he emphatically denies this in court papers, but he's not going to be able to come in and say that's not true.
Does that help Elizabeth?
That helps her, but still I think it's overwhelming for the defense to try to show this. She's been examined by a psychologist for the defense who's going to testify and also psychologists of the prosecution. So you're going to hear a psychological, you know, a lot of psychological expert testimony. And that'll come out both ways. One side will say, oh, yes, she was.
We've all seen a lot of Law and Order.
Yes.
We know how that works. Well, is she expected to testify?
She is, and I find this hard to believe, but she is expected to testify. Her lawyers have said that it's more likely than not. They told the judge that she'll testify. And in order to establish this defense, it seems like it would make sense that the best would be to have her saying this rather than to have a psychologist saying she told me this.
Right.
But the problem is then the cross-examination. I mean, it's always a gamble to put someone on the stand, but here you can imagine some of the questions that you've been raising that the prosecutor is going to raise. Also, she was did a deposition with the SEC because she was charged by the SEC and settled those charges. And she 600 times said, I don't know. So now is she going to say, I know, and she never told the SEC that she was involved with Sonny Balwani and that she was under his control. So
you understand the legal world. Who do you think has the tougher case? Is it the prosecution or the defense?
Prosecution has the burden of proof, so they have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense only has to get one juror to hang it up, but I still think the defense has the tougher case to make here, just case for case.
Okay, and is it like if she loses – what then, what's the impact on her?
Well, the longest sentence would be 20 years, but she'll probably...
So jail time.
Yes, absolutely. She's charged with multiple conspiracy counts and fraud counts. So this is it's very serious. And also the prosecutors want to make, I think they want to make an example out of her that, you know, for Silicon Valley, because there have been a lot of startups, you know, that just...
Yep.
they're wild, they're great, and then they just fail miserably. Why did they pick on her? A lot of people have been asking that question. So they really want to prove their case, and they want to prove that you can't do this. There's a line, and you can't cross that line.
Well, fascinating to watch, and I know you'll be covering it big time for us, and looking forward to all of your coverage. June,
thank you so much.
June Grosso. She's Bloomberg News legal analyst, and you can catch her weeknights at 10 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. She is host of Bloomberg Law.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.